This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, train language to sit, sit, sit. Okay, lie down. No, lie down. No, get off me. No! Coming up in today's show.
I personally did not want to die in the middle of a 1980s like power ballad in like a dingy bar in Edinburgh.
Yes, returning to Eclipse, one of my favourite Allusionist pieces, because I wanted to hear it again. And there is particularly beautiful music in it by Martin Austwick. Martin makes all of the music you hear on The Allusionist, but I'll let you into a secret. Usually it's his own songs that he's written for his band Pale Bird, but with the vocals removed. Not this time, because there is a significant song in the story, so I asked him to learn to play it and then take it apart to create new music out of it to score this piece. If you haven't heard Eclipse before, get ready. Also, content note, the piece is about a health crisis, but spoiler, everyone survives. If you have heard Eclipse before, I've added a couple of little updates, thanks to which I now also have to add a warning that there are some Category A swears in it. On with the show.
Words were everything in my life. It was all day, every day, on stage, off stage, on the page.
Let's just go back to what happened to you.
Oh, sure.
How old were you?
I was 27. In 2007, I was an actress and a director and a PhD student in New York. And there was absolutely no warning. I mean, I was actually performing on stage when it happened. I went on stage to perform a karaoke duet.
What was the song?
It was Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Wrong organ.
I know, but it's okay to laugh because I just really am glad I didn't die doing that. So anyways, I was on stage, I was singing, now I'm only falling apart. And I was up singing the song, and then I was down. Nothing I can do, a total eclipse of the... I collapsed immediately because it was not known to me at the time, but an aneurysm had ruptured in my brain, and it was hemorrhaging.
An aneurysm is a weakness in a blood vessel in the brain. It's estimated that 1 in 50 people has such a weakness, but most will never even know about it. Only about 1 in 25,000 aneurysms causes trouble. As she later found out, Lauren Marks had two aneurysms in her brain, and one of those was that 1 in 25,000. It ruptured, and she had a stroke. Karaoke interrupted, Lauren was taken to hospital. When she woke up, she had undergone brain surgery. But something else had changed.
When I woke up in the Edinburgh Hospital, I had very little language. Speaking, reading, and writing were all dramatically affected. I probably only had about 40 or 50 words at my disposal.
Lauren had aphasia.
Which is an acquired language disorder that comes after you have already honed all your language skills.
Also known as dysphagia, aphasia can happen after a brain injury, a stroke, an accident, an aneurysm.
It just leaves your language impoverished depending on what type you have. It makes words inaccessible to you.
At that time, though, Lauren didn't know that she used to have a full vocabulary and now didn't. She used to be able to read and now couldn't. She used to have an internal monologue and now didn't. And ignorance really was bliss.
I couldn't have been any more peaceful and satisfied.
She didn't have an inner voice telling her to panic. She didn't have the vocabulary to panic. So she didn't panic.
Knowing what you don't know is a really big issue with a brain injury. Language is the organ of perception. So if there's an injury to your perception, like your perception can be real off. So, I mean, in my case, with my aphasia, I didn't know how damaged my language was. I really had no idea. I thought that it was just fine.
But Lauren's friends and parents who'd gathered around her hospital bed did not think it was just fine. Moreover, they didn't know that she didn't know it wasn't fine.
But they always assumed that I was experiencing what they thought I'd be experiencing, which is like terror and disappointment and desire to get out of the hospital, all those things. But because I didn't really feel any different, you know, I mean, I did feel different, but I didn't feel bad. I didn't have that landscape of terror that could have been appropriate. But I'm really glad I couldn't think that. And does happen to differ from people with aphasia. Some people lose their inner monologue and some people do not. I did. So I didn't have that little voice go, oh, you're in a world of trouble. Miss Marks, you know, you are in a world of trouble. I didn't receive that message.
Did you have a better time only having 40 words?
Absolutely, actually. Meaning I wasn't focusing on the words. When I was, it was very frustrating. But when I wasn't, I was experiencing a much more serene, perceptual environment. What I was really embracing was this profound quiet. Externally and internally, I didn't have any more murmuring. You know, I didn't have that sort of hamster wheel of anxiety of like, what am I doing? What has happened? What do I need to do now? None of that was really engaged. So I just felt really part of where I was. This quiet was absolutely nourishing.
If other people were talking, could you get what they were saying?
Yeah, I could understand. That was a very lucky thing. I mean, I think probably the best aspect of my condition was I was like, I understood almost everything I heard. Perhaps I didn't get everything, but it felt like I did.
You wouldn't have known.
Exactly.
You didn't. Great.
No, but that's it. That you've nailed it. That's the most beneficial kind of injury. It's like you don't know what's wrong with you until you get better. The better I got, the more aware of my deficits I was. And that, you know, not so great. It's like there's a pros and cons to language. You know, when I became more aware of my deficits, so the moments in which I had the least is also the moments when I was worried the least. And there was like this sort of period of time in which I became aware that I wasn't being able to say all the things I wanted to say. And that was still not the most anxiety-producing time. The most anxiety-producing time after the aneurysm rupture was when some of it was coming back and it was trying to organize it all. It wasn't the absence that was scary, it was the surplus.
The 40 words that Lauren started off with were not all that useful in her situation.
Paint, Italy, people, bullets, mines. They're not things that are
thematically linked.
No, not thematically linked. Not thematically linked. It's just, that's a thing. You don't start with the vocabulary of someone commensurate with your language skills. You don't start at the vocabulary of a four-year-old. You start with the experience of a 27-year-old woman. And so you get a hodgepodge of crazy times. I mean, Catherine the Great was pretty high up. Like, she came in my first, like, month.
Do you have a particular affiliation for her?
Nope. No. But here, this one, there she is. So Catherine, so it's not spelled correctly, but Catherine Prussia Horse Donk.
Horse Donk. Catherine Prussia Horse Donk. Lauren's brain had clung on to the knowledge of the Prussian-born Empress of Russia who, according to rather lurid myth, had died whilst trying to have sex with a horse. Catherine the Great had actually died of a stroke, but Lauren's mind probably didn't make that connection deliberately, so who knows why those particular words stuck.
The words that stick are usually nouns for concrete things. But what's not on here is any words for feelings. Sad, scared, confused.
Lauren was also missing what she calls the connective tissue of language.
Like, of, through, inside, you know, like, some of them are small words, some of them are modifying words, they just don't mean as much.
Lauren was talking strangely too, lots of mangled words and repetition, and a lot of swearing. It's not uncommon that when you lose language because of a stroke or dementia, swearing is the vocabulary that clings on the longest, which makes me feel some slight comfort for my future. It's not ideal in every situation, though, such as in hospital wards.
You know, I think a woman across from me had Huntington's disease. I just really couldn't say that. And I kept saying cunt. Like, instead of Huntington's, I kept saying cunt or cuntington. And I kept trying. My dad's like, no, stop saying it. And I was like, I just kept saying cunt. And I was like, but what's the problem?
Lauren only realized something was seriously amiss when, a few weeks after the stroke, she opened a book and the letters just looked like lumps. She worked with speech and language therapists in Edinburgh and then in her hometown of LA, where she'd moved back in with her family. Over the next several months, she practiced reading and writing, making painstaking progress.
Slowly, I became able to read in very small bits, and a sentence a day, then one paragraph a day, then a page a day.
To aid her language recovery, Lauren kept a journal and spent several hours a day writing an essay about what had been happening with her. Her language skills were improving, but it wasn't easy. The 3-page essay took her 6 months to finish. But at least with reading and writing, Lauren could control the pace of language. If she couldn't process words fast, she could read them slowly. However, she couldn't do that when someone was speaking to her. Too many words, too fast. So the supportive presence of her family and friends could sometimes be overwhelming.
Yes, they were stressful because they're loud to me. I mean, almost anybody who has aphasia will tell you that it's like suddenly there are so many levels of sound, and you're taking in this whole world of sound, and you're trying to manage it all. And some of it is language. Language is a big part of it. But there's just like clinking and clanking, and there's echoes. And you know, you're really just, it's nauseating trying to focus and narrow to have the simplest of conversations. It was like a carnival, and it was like so a loving carnival. So it was nice to be surrounded by such many great, wonderful, supportive, loving people. But I would just tune off, and they would be like, you know, prodding me to do certain things, and they assumed that I was depressed. But I wasn't depressed, I was exhausted. I was exhausted by them, and it was, the only time I was really like relieved is kind of when they left. They would just sit here and they would ask me, do you remember this? You know, do you want to say that? Try this, say this. And all of it just seemed like, everyone kept saying, you'll be back to your old self again. And I just didn't like that. I felt so good, and they were talking about a different person, and I couldn't remember that person's life very well. And I really liked what I was doing. I liked that I was able to engage with language as I had as a kid. You know, I liked it. I don't want to go back to that old self again. Like, I don't know who that person was, but this is a beautiful time. This gift of wordlessness is like a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and I am getting better, and I want to get better, but do you know the price that I'm paying? The price is clutter. Like, now, of course, I can see how narrow that view was. You know what I mean? I also had lost all of my abilities, and like my parents were shouldering the entire burden of my life and livelihood and my, you know, care.
Lauren's relationships with her family and friends and boyfriend were affected by her aphasia, not only because her abilities to communicate had changed, and so had she, but also because she couldn't recall a lot of their shared history. This made for a particularly weird situation with her boyfriend, whom she'd been dating on and off for about 5 years at the time of the stroke. Then after it, she couldn't really remember him. It was this weirdly asymmetrical relationship where it was long-term for him, and for her, this fresh new thing. And only he could remember their baggage. She would beg him to just tell her what they used to argue about before. And he didn't want to, obviously, because one of those things they'd used to argue about was him having cheated. Because language and memory are so entwined, she'd lost a lot of that shared experience.
The memory was an issue, but it wasn't because I became amnesic. I just think language is part of it. I mean, language has so much call and response, and there's so much emotion embedded in that.
And when you're close to someone, over the years of knowing each other, you build up a kind of mutual language. Little cues, shared references, vocabulary that means something particular in the context of your relationship. Lauren's loved ones still had that, but she didn't.
There are ways you comfort each other in language. There is a lot of shorthand, there's inside jokes, and all of those were gone. And when people would do those things, assuming that I felt the same way, I was profoundly alienated by it. I just saw it really from a distance, like, oh, they think that's funny. I get that. I get that they think that's funny.
So you've registered it.
Yeah.
You're not feeling it.
But definitely not feeling it. And no speed to it, no fluency to it. As soon as you're just one step out of line, I'm not saying that anyone of my friends wanted or anyone's in my family wanted me to feel excluded. In fact, quite the opposite. But you know it. You know it. It's like trying to run in a river. Like everything is just pushing, and you're making an effort, and the effort is something, but it is not the right effort. You should be swimming, and you're trying to run. They became aware slowly. The people who were with me all the time started to realize how profound the lack was.
Did the shared jokes come back?
Some of them, yeah, some of them. And also but you need to have both the speed for that to matter. The joke, even if you understand it, is not so funny if it takes a little longer to get it. Do you know what I mean? It's like you can only appreciate it if it is sort of bubbling at the same, you know, you're boiling at the same rate in the same pot.
Although I suppose when it's people that you have a long acquaintance with, often it's just a reference to the fact that you have that bond rather than the joke having to function as a joke on its own.
Right, and you do like 1/15th of the joke, right? You just like, you nod at an aspect of it and that's enough.
Jokes also often rely on the knowledge that the words are not to be interpreted literally. But this was a concept Lauren could not grasp for quite a while after her stroke. She took language at face value.
I'd lost all my idioms. Every idiom was so visual to me, like flying off the handle. I'd be like imagining kitchen pots with wings. It's like nothing with handles flies, you know, it didn't make sense. It really was like I was a foreigner in my own tongue. So those were exciting moments, or lots of like, oh, look, English is funny. Like, this is so weird. And then every milestone, and like these milestones could be anything from homonyms, you know, like, oh, words have multiple meanings, like, you know, you could toast somebody at a party, or you can eat toast with jam. Those were really exciting moments to experience languages. I did as a child, you know, really marvelous and glorious and fun. And oh, another really important one was reading between the lines.
While reading a short story by Ernest Hemingway, Lauren had an epiphany.
In that epiphany, I realized, like, oh, it's not about what's written here. It's about all the things that's left off the page, what's not written. I said to my best friend, I was like, it's something else. It's like what's not happening. And she's like, oh, you mean you're reading between the lines? And I was like, oh my God. Like, yeah, that's it. Like, read it. She's like, oh, you mean like subtext? I was like, subtext. I mean, like, that word was like fireworks and like, you know, volcanoes exploding. And I'm like, subtext. I was a 27-year-old PhD student, actress, director, who had completely forgot the existence of subtext.
Lauren was having a delightful time getting to know language again, but the aphasia often scrambled her attempts to express her thoughts to other people. And when someone's outward language usage does not appear to be on the same level as ours, we're prone to making assumptions. Did people treat you like you were stupid?
In the first year, yeah. I mean, it was really interesting. If I had been sort of working at the same level, I'd probably been offended a lot more. But I was often much more curious. Like, so I looked fine, which was like, you know, girl with red lipstick and somewhat hip, you know, at a coffee shop. There'd been a couple times that someone would flirt with me then I would say something, and I don't know what I would say, but clearly it came out like clunk a chunk chunk chunk. And I saw a lot of visible gulps. Like, there was a lot of like, and I thought, oh, so that's what's happening. So that guy thinks I'm dumb. Huh. That guy's dumb. You're saved by my own vanity and delusion. Vanity and delusion can be a really, a very fantastic combination when you're going through a brain injury.
Since Lauren's aneurysm burst in 2007, a lot has happened in her life. The boyfriend she'd been seeing for about 5 years at the time of the stroke, they broke up. Then Lauren met a man on a rooftop in Lebanon. They fell in love instantly, they got married, and they now have 2 children. I asked her for an update for this rerun. She said, "My eldest is about to start kindergarten in the fall, and he is verbal AF. The youngest is 18 months. He is both incredibly communicative and not at all interested in using words. So the household dynamic of my non-native English speaker husband, an aphasic, a lippy preschooler, and a largely prelingual toddler is a real language trip." Lauren's work life is very different now too. She couldn't go back to acting because she could no longer memorise scripts. Nor could she return to her PhD, as when you're reading and writing academic papers, if you make mistakes with that connective tissue of language, the ofs and the fors, it can make a critical difference to the meaning. Her work now is all about communication, and she's written a book about her aneurysm and recovery. It's called A Stitch of Time. Her language recovered far more than it does for a lot of people with aphasia, but it was never the same as before.
When I try to use idioms, they're still quite off.
I don't think you're missing much.
No, I don't think so either. I don't miss them. You can keep them. Even now we have this conversation and I don't have a lot of word finding problems, but when I'm writing, I still have problems. I still leave words off the page and I put the wrong words in the wrong place. Like, I leave all kinds of the connective tissue of sentences out. I replace pronouns. I say I when I mean to say he or she or they. You know, all of those things are just, they're predictable. They're parts of the disorder and they're called paraphasias and like they're textbook. They are truly textbook disorders. And 10 years later, even at the highest level of what I've achieved, it happens every single day.
She does seem to have stopped saying cunt all the time, though.
I have these small things that are really just tiny linguistic hiccups. To me, I love them. I love them. I mean, I would try to fix them if I could, but I can't, and I don't, and I'm glad that I can't. I don't ever want to forget the glory of discovery. I don't want to make language be ordinary. It's so easy, you know, you can, once you've got all the tricks up your sleeve, then you're, you know, that's a great idiom. I'm like the thing that, the everlasting gift, and you really have to cultivate it because you can forget it, but like, I'm glad that I remember that language is not ordinary. I want that. I want to keep that feeling.
The Illusionist is an independent podcast, and so is Flash Forward, made by a friend of the pod, Rose Eveleth, who you heard on The Illusionist talking about the phrase, "The future is now!" And I think you'll enjoy her brand new book, Flash Forward, an illustrated guide to possible and not-so-possible tomorrows. Questions and possibilities for the future are brought to life by 12 amazing comics and graphic artists. Gaze into the future and flash forward in book form and pod form, wherever you usually get those things. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is intrigant. Noun, a person who plots something illicit or harmful. Try using intrigant in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. The original music was composed by Martin Austwick of palebirdmusic.com. You can find his songs if you search for Palebird on Spotify and Bandcamp. In this episode, you heard from Lauren Marks, and in her book, A Stitch of Time, you can read a lot more about how aphasia feels, how she recovered her language, and how the aphasia affected her close relationships. You can also find a lot of aphasia resources at her website, astitchoftime.com. Yes, that is of, not in. You know, the connective tissue of language. You can find the show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Allusionist Show. And if you fancy funding the show and getting behind-the-scenes glimpses, you can become a patron for as little as $2 a month at patreon.com/allusionist. Plus, to hear or read every episode, find out more information about the topics therein, see the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, and a lexicon of all the words the show has covered, visit the show's forever home, theallusionist.org.